Hi everyone, welcome to this week's episode of Energy in Action. I'm your host, Stephanie. Our podcast is brought to you by our sponsors, Zogenics and Ultragenics. Here on Energy in Action, we talk all things Mito. Our goal is to be informational and entertaining. And today's episode is definitely informational. I am speaking with Lucas Lang, the CEO and co-founder of Probably Genetic. Lucas is a Rhodes Scholar and PhD candidate in the rare genetic diseases at the University of Oxford. He is an expert in genomics and worked on the world's largest rare disease project. He aims to find diagnoses and treatment for the millions of people worldwide who are afflicted with a rare disease. Lucas and co-founder Dr. Harley Katz started Probably Genetic to make genetic testing available to all patients in need. Hi, Lucas. Thanks for joining us today for this conversation about Probably Genetic. I know you and I have already had a conversation going over a lot of the specifics, and I can't wait to share all of this information with our listening audience. I find your concept and what you're doing absolutely brilliant, and I think is going to be process changing for many families. So go ahead and introduce yourself and let everybody know how all this started.
Yeah, thanks, Stephanie. It's great to meet you, and I really appreciate you having me on the podcast. And I also should say I'm incredibly impressed with the work you guys do at Mito Action. I know you have the website and all the materials you guys put out are not indicative of the size of the team, which is incredibly impressive to me. Probably Genetic is a, as the name suggests, genetics company. Our mission is diagnosing 200 million rare genetic disease patients. We think that's roughly the number of people on the planet that suffer from rare diseases and are undiagnosed. I went to grad school at the University of Oxford as a Rhodes Scholar in genetics, where the core focus of my work was helping more rare disease patients find answers by analyzing their whole genome sequencing data. So I mainly worked on the data side of things. And one of the projects I got to work on is the world's largest rare genetic disease study. And one thing that's true across diseases, and this really struck me, was for the vast majority of these diseases, patients go through what we call the diagnostic odyssey, where you've got a multi-year phase where patients are severely ill and often increasingly ill without knowing what's causing their disease. And testing technology is a really great way to make that period shorter because people suffer in a lot of different ways during that time. And the founding hypothesis of Probably Genetic was, we think there are ways to use all kinds of different technology to make that waiting period shorter of people starting to have symptoms and not knowing what's going on. So that's where the company came from.
Wow. I know when we were talking prior to today or just today earlier, I had told you that our genetic testing basically took for my son probably close to 4.5 years of different blood draws, different this, different that, and going through all kinds of hoops and false hopes. And it was wonderful the day we finally got the call that they said, we think we found it. And you would have thought we were looking for a new planet. In my eyes, we were. Mm-hmm. We were, you know, sadly, what they found led us to absolutely nothing different in the care of my son. But just knowing that we have found part of what the link is, like the key to the lock, is so reassuring to families. And like you said, it really helps with the treatment and the diagnosis and the validation of what a patient is feeling. And it definitely points the medical team in a more certain direction. I hate to use the word into the correct direction, but it's a more certain direction because as you've, I'm sure, have learned, you start down one path and then something genetic shows up and you have to take a hard left or a hard right, but at least you know you're going in the right direction.
One family that we've worked with a lot, the way that the dad in that family was describing their experience of not knowing what the diagnosis is and then at least knowing what the diagnosis is, he said it's kind of like being out on the open sea and everything's dark and you're in a tiny boat and it's rocky. And when you get a diagnosis, at the very least, you know which direction you need to head in to get back to shore. You're not back at shore yet because we only have treatments for 5% of all rare genetic diseases, and there's roughly 10,000 of these diseases. But the good news is both the number of genes identified that are causing these diseases goes up every single year by about 100 to 150. And the number of clinical trials and treatments out there is going up every single year as well. So we're making a lot of progress, but the journey is not over.
No, the journey has literally just got to the starting line, in my opinion. What I think is great about probably genetic is that by allowing a consumer facing product, you are able to do what I encourage all of our patients to do, and that is become involved in your care. Take charge, own your data, own what you know, and get the ball rolling yourself and become engaged and not just be passive. And so I find your approach and process so refreshing, and I can't wait to hear all of the things that you have learned along the way. So let's go with, how long have you been testing? Do you know how many tests you've done so far?
We started the company in late 2018. It took about a year to launch the product because the interface on the website we think looks pretty simple, which is what the goal is. The eventual goal is, if you need a test, you visit the website, you click a button and you get a test. There is a ton of stuff that goes on in the background. We have an entire countrywide network of telemedicine physicians that review every single test order and can fill prescriptions. We have a large team of analysts. There is a lab in the background that does all the logistics and the test itself. And there is genetic counselors involved as well. So it took a solid year of like pretty hard work to even get the first person tested. I don't know exactly how many people we've tested since. I'd say there are two important findings. There are many important findings, but I'll highlight the two most important ones. The first one is, in this clinical direct-to-consumer framework we've built, diagnostic yield is high, meaning we are finding a lot of people who test positive via a mechanism like this that previously did not have access to testing. That was an important validation point for us because we kind of set out with this hypothesis that we think there is a lot of people who will receive results from this. And the second important finding is, and I think this is less surprising, but it's important, is most people suffering from chronic illnesses struggle affording testing like this, which is where the motivation for us came from to build up sponsor testing programs where patients can get tested completely for free and never incur any costs. And we, at the same time, can help the drug development community find people for trials or even for approved treatments and kind of make a match where hopefully both sides get something out of the equation.
Excellent. Yeah. And I think that's a quiet part of the clinical trial research piece that a lot of the patients don't understand, is that we need to get the data to the researchers so they can look at what drug needs to be developed and what are the needs of the community and what is the data showing. I always use the analogy with families, where sometimes we have drug companies that think all of our patients want to have green hair, but then we go through a natural history study and they find out that really all of our patients just want to have less fatigue. And so they have to reconfigure their thoughts on what they want to develop. So I think, like with you and your product, with probably genetic, you are able to come back to your sponsor company and say, we have found X amount of patients with this variant or this deletion. This is a good place to start. And we need numbers. We need mass in order for a sponsor company to take notice and say, you're right, we can do that. So you're with a sponsorship company now that have a sponsorship that looks for patients with mitochondrial disease, correct?
The scope of the project is mitochondrial disease. Okay. Yeah.
Okay. And so how can our community, the mitochondrial disease and MitoAction families, how can they participate in this? I know we've had some information out on our website and within our social media, and we've had a lot of discussion, informal discussion about, you know, what does this look like? What does this mean? Simply, they can just go to the website and they can get started, correct?
Yeah, there's the website link is mito.probablygenetic.com, which has all the instructions on it, but it's very simple. There is a big button at the top that says get started, I think, or take the quiz, and you click on that, and then you're guided into a symptom checker where at the very beginning, we ask that people agree to the informed consent and the terms of service of using the symptom checker. And then we ask a series of questions, including the person's age, whether or not they're the patient themselves, or if this is for one of their loved ones, you know, either kids or other family members, previous testing history. You know, a lot of people would have done muscle biopsies in the past, or lactic acidosis tests or anything like that, or genetic testing. And then we ask a series of questions about either disease suspicions or confirmed diseases people might have, as well as, most importantly, symptoms. And there is, I'd say it's pretty quick. I don't know if you've tried it, but I think it probably takes 2 minutes, roughly, maybe.
Oh, yeah. More. Less than five for sure. It's pretty simple.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then at the end of it, people submit their answers through the symptom checker. There's a small number of preliminary checks we do to see if in general we would be able to test that person. We have a small list of exclusion criteria. We currently cannot provide testing to people in New York, New Jersey, and Rhode Island, and any countries that are not the United States. So if people are in those locations, we currently cannot qualify them for testing. And then the data that people submitted to us goes into a review process where we do, at a high level, two things. The first one is we have an algorithm that tries to figure out automatically if people, based on their symptoms and the other information they submitted, look like they have a mitochondrial disease where we can deliver a result with our test. And the second one is we do a quality review of the submission. The main motivation here is there is a very small percentage, but we do see some people completing the system who think this might be a way for me to get ancestry information, or this is just a way to get a free genetic test, even though they're not affected by the diseases that this service is supposed to be for. And for one, these tests we're doing are very expensive. They cost about $1,000 per person. So we want to allocate testing to people where it can actually help. And two, if people come into the service with misconceptions about what they're going to get, we're testing for diseases. If they, for example, thought this is a way for me to get a free ancestry test, then they would get filtered out in the end anyway, because our physicians review every single test request, and they have to fill a prescription, and they're not going to fill prescriptions for ancestry tests.
True.
So yeah. So the information gets reviewed. The eventual goal is to have this almost work instantaneously. We're a way away from that. I'd say the average wait time for people to hear back right now is probably a week to 2 weeks. Sometimes it's much faster. I think the fastest processing time is probably minutes. Sometimes it's towards like the end of that time frame. And then when people submit their information and they eventually get an email that says, you can take your test now, they have to give us a little more information that the physicians need for their review, which includes family history, medication history, and a couple other things. It's basically the information that you would tell your physician if you were with them in person, and they would do your, you know, intake. Except we do this online so that people don't have to go to physicians' practices in the pandemic. Then the information goes to the physicians, and if they say thumbs up, we can fill a prescription for this person. This test is medically necessary, which is a legal requirement to do the testing we do. Then the patient gets a status update. At this point, they're in our patient portal where they can see a timeline of exactly where's my request at. We then ship them a kit that's just a saliva collection tube. They collect their saliva, ship it back to our lab. All of that stuff is prepaid, and then the lab does the sequencing piece of it, and a whole range of quality control steps, and then we do the analysis of the test, and if we find a positive result, positive for like geneticists out there means likely pathogenic or pathogenic, or sometimes variants of uncertain significance, Then we ask the person taking the test or their caretaker to schedule a genetic counseling session. We have a wide network of really fantastic genetic counselors. And they then schedule the genetic counselor session. And ahead of the session, they get our clinical lab report, which tells them their testing result and pages and pages of other information that might be important for them. And then the genetic counselor walks them through their results for basically as long as it takes. And then finally, they also get a write-up from the genetic counselor where the genetic counselor sums up everything that they told the patient in that session so that the patient can focus on listening to the genetic counselor and the parents or patients don't feel like they also have to take notes alongside. Yeah.
So that's a very good, that's
lengthy
that's
explanation, but that's how.
That's a very good tool.
Yeah. But yeah, that's how it works. And then questions we often get are, why is my test free? Right? Yes. Like, what's the catch? And there are exactly. There's no catch, but there are two ways in which we use data. We never pass on identifiable information. So the data that goes externally can never be used to re-identify someone. But there's two data points that we report back to sponsors. The first one are aggregate insights on the people completing the symptom checker. For example, what percentage of the people completing the symptom checker have myopathy? Or what's the average age of onset people are reporting? And then the other thing is, if people test positive, who are the treating physicians or who's the treating physician of that patient? Because people who are actually part of the testing program, that's not people who take the symptom checker, but only people who actually do the test, as part of the intake, have to inform us who their physicians are. And the sponsoring company on their end want to know which physicians are treating patients that tested positive. Because if the eventual goal is to enroll some people in clinical trials, the physicians are supposed to be the gatekeepers of the healthcare system for a good reason.
Right.
It shouldn't be anyone else. It certainly shouldn't be drug developers. If there was a patient who tests positive for a disease where a trial exists, the sponsoring company would be able to approach the physician and say, we don't know who your patient is, but we think you have somebody who might be a match for this trial. Here's more information about the trial. If you, as a physician, think this trial makes sense for your patient, please tell them about this trial. And then the patient family can proactively decide, do we think this makes sense for us or do we not think it makes sense?
Wow. I like that. I like that, how nicely you explained that transfer of information, because that is something that concerns people. Obviously, yeah. There's a lot. There is some mistrust in the rare disease community because a lot of people have been given misinformation, wrong information. Diagnoses have changed. For instance, my son was diagnosed with cerebral palsy for the first few years of his life, just so we could get him a label to get him services. And then that has morphed into mitochondrial disease. But sometimes people don't morph into the correct diagnosis, and so I think it's great that you just said, we tell the companies reach out to the doctors, the gatekeepers, and say, we have identified a patient that you have strictly by these symptoms or this study. Could you please look at your patient community and pass out this information to see who might want to participate? And I think everybody needs to understand that everything is de-identified. And it is strictly scientific data at this point. There is absolutely no social construct happening whatsoever.
Yeah.
And I think that's important.
The only way for genetic data to leave our system, so genetic data stays completely in our system, except for when patients or families decide we want to download our data, because none of the data that we generate via the testing or anything else is owned by us. That data is owned by the patients. If you do the testing, there is a simple button in your patient interface where you can say download genetic data. And the only thing that we ask patients and families to do before they download their data is is an informed consent process we have, where we explain in simple terms, this is what the relevance of the data is you're about to download to your computer. Please make sure you keep it secure and don't pass it on to any people where you don't know what they do with your data. But that data, there is no other way for that data to come out of our system.
Wow, that is, I like that. And you do. I've gone through quite a few of the different steps, and it is very simply spelled out. And we at Mito Action can't stress enough to patients and families, please do not just send us raw data. I can't interpret it for the life of me. I don't have my magic decoder ring. I've never gone to school for that. I'm a public health major. And so please, keep that very, hold that close to you and only give it to people who can truly be beneficial with that information. So there's a lot of new terms now that go out and about with genetic testing. And I think something that is confusing yet to people is, what is whole genome sequence testing? Can you describe that for everyone?
Yeah, that's totally fair. We actually, on our main website, we have an entire blog post written about exactly that subject, because it's the most frequent question we get. There's a range, not all genetic tests are created equal. There is a whole range of different testing technologies. Some are really old, others are new. I'm going to explain four different types of tests that most people in the community, or at least some people in the community, might have heard of. The oldest one, and the one that's got the, in general, lowest diagnostic yield, meaning lowest likelihood to return results, is a chromosomal microarray, CMA. For any families out there who have children with developmental concerns, there is a good chance you've come across this term. That's a technology that's from like the 80s, and it's good at detecting larger deletions or insertions in the genome, but it cannot detect if an individual letter in your DNA is flipped into another letter, which is, we call that a single nucleotide variant, SNV. So it can detect some mutations, but it cannot detect others. Then the next level up from this is a gene panel, which a lot of people out there would have heard of. A gene panel can be as small as, maybe a dozen genes, or can be as big as 1,500 genes, maybe, where the gene panel tests a series of pre-selected genes. So for example, if you're with a neurologist, your neurologist might say, we're going to do a gene panel for epilepsy or seizures. And then there's a whole lot of genes on the test that are known to cause epilepsies or seizures or anything related. What the panel doesn't detect is if the gene that your patient or you have a mutation in is not on the panel. And there are some genes, if you got a panel done 5 years ago, the gene that might be causing your condition might not have been known, so it's not on the panel. So gene panels have a fairly solid diagnostic yield, I'd say between 10% in the best of cases, sometimes even 30%, but that's rare. And then the next level up from that is whole exome sequencing, which is the testing technology we use. Whole exome sequencing is sort of like the biggest gene panel you could think of, because it tests almost every one of the over 20,000 genes in the human body. It covers about 85% of all mutations that we as scientists know to be disease causing. And in our view, whole exome sequencing is sort of the best of, or the best balance between two different things, diagnostic yield and cost, because it's much cheaper than whole genome sequencing. But in diagnostic yield, it's currently pretty close. It's not 100%, but it's like close to what whole genome sequencing can do. And whole genome sequencing sequences your entire DNA. So not just your genes, because your genes only make up about 2% of your DNA. It sequences everything. And whole genome sequencing can sort of be thought of as a combination of whole exome sequencing and the chromosomal microarray I mentioned before. Neither one of those individual ones can do everything that whole genome sequencing does, but whole genome sequencing can do everything and more than what whole exome sequencing and a CMA does. That's hard to understand. And then you previously mentioned a question, which is how do consumer infotainment tests like 23andMe or Ancestry slot in? Mm-hmm. They're more or less what a chromosomal microarray is, except there is a little more sampled in. But there are the array that those guys run is not meant for the diagnosis of rare diseases because it predetermines which mutations you look for. But the problem is with rare diseases, your genome doesn't care which mutation you're looking for. It just creates mutations all over the place. And very often somebody will be sick because they have a disease-causing mutation, but it's simply not covered on one of the consumer health tests. Exactly. So they're just designed for different purposes. They're not supposed to be clinical tests.
Yes, and we get that question many times. Is it, can I run a 23andMe and help figure out if I have mitochondrial disease? And I always say, nope, but you can learn if you're gonna have Scottish ancestry or not, because that's strictly what it's for. And it's truly a lineage or ancestry test. And I love that you have a consumer facing that is medically and diagnostic testing available. Back to though, another question I get, and it's basically because mm-hmm. it's the route we chose. What is the advantage for a patient and their family to do TRIO testing?
Yeah, that's a great question. We also have a blog post on that because people ask that a lot. So there is a few things to be said about that. The first one is it makes the diagnosis easier for the analysts because there is different ways in which genetic disease can be inherited. And if the patient has a disease where clinically we would suspect that it's dominant, which would mean it's passed down by either the mom or the dad, and we find a mutation in the patient, if we didn't sequence the parents, we have no way of determining if that particular mutation was passed down from the parent or if that's maybe a false positive. But if we have the parents, we can compare the patient's DNA to the parent's DNA and see, was it passed down from a parent? And if so, does the parent have the same disease as your patient? If the answer is yes, the parents got the same disease as your patient, and the variant only appears in the parent that's sick as well as in the patient that's sick, then that's a really strong indicator that we found the candidate. However, if the parent had the same mutation but wasn't sick, there is a stronger chance that that mutation is not actually the variant we're looking for to explain what's causing disease in the patient. And that applies across different inheritance modes, but I think that's probably the best way to explain it. That's piece one. And then the second piece is TRIO testing can give you some information for other family members, because if you were to find, if you've got a patient that's ill and you've got a parent that's ill and they both have the same variant, you can inform the parents about recurrence risk in other kids they might have. Because if you've got a dominant condition, the chance is 50% that another child might get the same condition. It's like, for some people, it's important for family planning.
Definitely.
And then there's other aspects to it as well, but I think this is probably the most important piece.
I like that. Like I said, we did the TRIO testing only to find that our son was considered a de novo, but it was mm-hmm. good to know because it kept the ship moving in the right direction. So it's always good information. So another one that we get asked is, and I think you've already explained this, but so many of our patients say, well, I was tested in 2010. And I strongly encourage mm-hmm. people to go back and get tested again because so much has changed. How often should somebody retest, and can they retest through you simply by just asking to be retested, or do they have to go through the whole process and resubmit a sample?
Yeah, so for how often should people get retested, I don't think I have a great answer for that. And I don't think there are any standards in the clinical community yet. What I can tell you is the diagnostic yield goes up by about 10% every single year, meaning if diagnostic yield for a specific test would have been 20% last year, it's probably 22% this year, purely wow. based on more publications being out there and studies advancing. So that gives you some understanding of how to think about what's my likelihood of getting a result if I didn't get one last year. And then for reanalysis or retesting, we run reanalyses. We currently do this on an annual basis, and we currently do this for free. That might change in the future. For people who are part of the free testing program, this is never going to cost anything. For people who are part of our paid service, we'll kind of have to see, because reanalysis is expensive, because we always have two different analysts and a lab director look at every single sample for hours and try to figure out what's going on. So it's a lot of really expensive personnel that kind of has to look at it. It's unfortunately, with complex testing like whole exome or whole genome sequencing, not an entirely automated process. Or if you were thinking of an MRI, you don't have to go in and get the same MRI done again, but your radiologist, who's an expensive physician, has to sit there again and like look at your image and try to figure out if there's something they missed. It's kind of the same principle.
I like that. That's a really good analogy.
Yeah, I should also add, we do find results every single time we reanalyze.
Okay, so how long is this available for our mitochondrial disease community? Is this ongoing? Do we have a timeline we need to get as many people signed up? I guess that was another question.
Yeah, we're currently, we're going to enroll people currently until March 23rd. So for like another just under 2 weeks. Okay. And then we're going to have to do a break and like see all the test results come out and see how well the program performed. And the hope is that if we can demonstrate diagnostic yield and this program is in fact really high, which we think it will be, then we have a reasonable argument to say we should make this bigger and get more people testing, which is very likely going to include people that submitted information but didn't make the cut the first time around, either because of time or symptomatic history. And then we will probably also do more outreach to get to more communities.
Okay. And are you accepting people of all ages, or do you have a specific age group that you would like to see submitted right now?
We don't test kids under two right now. But aside from that, no age cutoff.
Wow. Okay. Wow. This is so fascinating. I can't wait to watch your publications come out on what you're finding, and hopefully you'll keep us up to date on what's next and how else we can help you build this information, because it's fascinating to me how you and groups like yourself are finally intrigued with our patient population. For the longest time, everybody was like, yeah, we don't got time for them. But now people are starting to find out that, wow, mitochondrial disease really is interwoven into a lot of things. And just looking at the connections, I think is what's spurring on this rise in studies and clinical trials and just plain research, which I'm very fascinated with.
So. Yeah. The one thing that people could do, there's two things people could do right now that actually would be helpful, which is, for one, if they think they would qualify and they haven't completed the symptom checker yet, they can complete the symptom checker and they might get a test. And the other one is, if they are already part of the testing program, meaning they received an email that said, please complete the intake questionnaire now to get your test. Please complete the intake questionnaire to get your tests. And if you decided, sometimes we see people who say initially, I would like to get a genetic test, and then they've got a change of heart. That's totally fine. Just let us know so that we can give the test capacity to other people.
Right. Yeah. So either get in or get out, but Yeah, because like you said, there are only so many slots. So let's move that capacity on. And I understand that hesitation, because sometimes it's like, do you want to know what's behind door number three? You know, what's that going to change for me? So I understand that with some families, but for us, it was truly a victory of just knowing we were on the right path and we could breathe that what we were reporting in our son was actually confirmed with what his body was doing. So that isn't always the case for some people. So for us, it was a good thing to do.
So I completely get it. I think it's a very personal decision. Our intention is just to, you know, make it accessible to the people who actually want to use it.
Have you done it?
I've done every genetic test under the sun. I've been through our own testing process at least 3 times. It might have been more. Okay. And I've done a whole range of other ones. I did my PhD in this stuff, so I'm also just curious about it from a data perspective. I compare the results of different testing services to each other. I do the whole thing.
I think we are simpatico on that. I am a constant data comparisoner. I'm a consumerism of all things that can be put into a pivot table. Let's just put it that way. So anyway,
I like that. I'm the same way.
So let's ask some fun questions now. This is going to be rapid fire, mm-hmm. and this is just mm-hmm. some fun levity. So what is your favorite book?
The Earth is Flat.
Oh, boy, that's one I haven't heard. Okay. What's your favorite meal?
I really like seafood, but there's a warm apple pie that my mom made when I was a kid. So I'd say either, like, if we're talking desserts, the apple pie, and if we're talking mains, anything seafood.
We were in Genoa, Italy a few years back, and we had something I can only describe as like a seafood lasagna, and every other layer was like this delicious creature from the sea, all enveloped in some pesto and some cheese, and oh my gosh, it was absolutely delightful. So that I get that. Amazing. Oh, it was so good. What would be something that would just, if we took a picture of you experiencing just complete soul-filled joy, what would that be?
I think either, in the midst of my family or with a lot of friends. I'm a really social person. I hate being locked up right now, not seeing everybody. So I'm at my happiest when I'm around a lot of people I care about.
Really? See, I'm one of those, a true introvert. However, I do like to be out and about with people, but there are times when I'm just a true introvert and just really take that quality time to be with myself. So, all right. Well, Lucas, thank you so much for joining us today. I hope that we have another conversation soon to hear how things are going and how our community can stay involved and keep filling up your slots and keep your team busy and growing, because I think you guys are going to definitely unlock a lot of information.
I hope so, yeah.
All right. Well, thank you again.
Thank you so much for having me on, Stephanie. This was a lot of fun. Especially like the rapid fire thing at the end. That was cool.
Oh, good. Well, you know, I'm not trying to put you on Match.com or anything, but you know, sometimes it's nice to know how people think. So there you go.
Yeah.
All right. Well, good luck. And I'm glad to hear that your family's getting the vaccine and you can all get together again soon. Thank you so much, Lucas, for sharing all of the information about Probably Genetic. I am delighted to be in a partnership with you and help you find more data information to unlock the mysteries of mitochondrial disease. I hope all of our listeners enjoyed our conversation and learning more about Probably Genetic. And if you do have any questions, you can go to their website, which is probablygenetic.com. And they have a contact us button there, or a very, very large library of frequently asked questions. So feel free to peruse that. I'd like to thank everyone for tuning in to this week's episode of Energy in Action. Remember to give us a 5-star rating on your listening app. That helps boost us up the charts. This show is brought to you by MitoAction, Zogenics, Reneo, and Ultragenics. Be sure to join us next week for more All Things Mito. This is your host, Stephanie.